This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Since taking office almost 2 years ago, Virginia's current attorney general has infuriated liberals and delighted conservatives. He's also astonished most everyone. Fact is, when Ken Cuccinelli got elected by one of the biggest margins of victory ever, few voters would have predicted the controversies he'd take on. Not that he'd made any secret of his priorities, it just seems most people weren't paying attention. So are Virginians about to experience another round of surprise? Based on the latest election, Republicans will soon kick Democrats out of control of the state Senate. Might it be reasonable to think those things Republicans failed to enact before are now about to make it into law? And what might those things be? Expanded gun rights, tighter abortion restrictions, reduced education funding? Three state lawmakers, as well as our politics update team, have agreed to share their view. Yours is welcome, too, right after the news.
I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The Republican legislative agenda has gotten a big boost from voters. As a result of the latest election, Republicans have increased their majority in the House of Delegates to historic levels, and they've won effective control, it would seem, of the Virginia Senate. Does this mean a new day in Virginia lawmaking? There are plenty of high-profile measures that previously won approval in the House of Delegates, only to be stopped by Senate Democrats. Now, with the GOP in full control, are there proposals that you are looking forward to seeing enacted? Expanding capital punishment, getting tough on illegal immigration, allowing guns on college campuses. Are there proposals that give you pause? Taking money out of education and health care to help fund transportation, requiring a woman to view a sonogram before she's allowed to get an abortion. If you have any thoughts about what you'd like to see or what you would predict is likely to happen, now that Virginia's lawmaking process is fully controlled by one party, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Later in the hour, we expect to talk with three state lawmakers from the WMRA region, two who won re-election, one who did not. Cree Deeds, Jill Vogel, and Ed Hauck have all agreed to join us, but we start with our expert panel of astute political analyzers, Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Bob Roberts from the Politics Department at James Madison University. Welcome all back to Virginia Insight. So in terms of if what Republicans in the House have succeeded with in the past to see only die then in a Democratic controlled state Senate. Maybe we should go to you first, Anita. Are there specific measures now that the Republicans look like they're going to have control of the Senate that are likely to pass into law?
Sure. I mean, there are probably hundreds of bills that are proposed in the House that didn't really get anywhere in the Senate. They were either not heard or they were heard and then they died. And I would add it's the same for the other way. You know, the Democrats proposed many things that died in the House. So now that both chambers appear to be Republican, there are all sorts of things that we think will return. And I've talked to some delegates who are, you know, and senators who are pleased with that and have things that they're going to propose because they think they will pass.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about specifics in a moment, because you just underscored something that I guess maybe we should look at first. Bob Gibson, when Anita talks about the Senate appearing to be Republican, there's still some question?
There is. The House is undoubtedly Republican, as it is about two-thirds Republican in its membership. But the membership of the Senate is 20-20. And while the lieutenant governor
as of January,
right after the election.
When they take office.
When they take office, just before the January 11th session begins, as it begins. And there has been a history of the lieutenant governor casting some ties and breaking some ties, casting votes, but that does not apply across the board. There are certain things that the lieutenant governor is not entitled to vote on. So the Republicans have staked out the claim that they have a 21-20 majority with the tiebreaker being the lieutenant governor.
Who is a Republican, Bill Bowling.
Who is a Republican, Bill Bowling. But there are some issues that remain to be decided, and it depends on how much the Democrats want to press this. And now there are Democratic state senators, Edwards, Peterson, McEachin, talking about challenging the 21-20 majority because there are certain things that the Constitution says there are only 20 There are only 40 members of the Virginia Senate. So there are questions about how much control the Republicans really will have and whether some form, not full power sharing, that doesn't appear likely at all, but some form of maybe power sharing light might be on the table.
Attorney, public policy scholar, as well as political scientist and studier of the Virginia Constitution. You want to weigh in on this, Bob Roberts?
Yeah, there's a fascinating separation of powers question because clearly the lieutenant governor can vote on legislation. If there's a tie on a bill, the lieutenant governor can vote on those things and most laws. However, this is a reorganization question. This is, in a sense, organizing the Senate. Who controls the appointment to the committees? That is not a traditional function a non-senator would participate in. And I don't think the Virginia Constitution envisioned that a non-senator would play a role in that particular those decisions. And therefore,
the kinds of decisions of who heads up what committees?
Yes. Or? In other words, who controls the committees, which is the essential power in the Senate. And therefore, you could make a persuasive case to the Virginia Supreme Court that this is overreaching, that the Republicans are overreaching, and therefore they shouldn't be permitted to do so. But the question remains, see, if you try that to make that case, there's a possibility a Democrat might be able to be persuaded to vote with the Republicans. So there's a risk. If you go to court, the governor may be able to persuade a Democrat to say, there is no longer a 2020. I will vote with the Republicans. So if you go that strategy, there's a risk it might not work unless you hold your caucus entirely together.
There is some history on this, is there not, Bob Gibson, back in the mid-90s when you were still a reporter and editor for the Daily Progress newspaper?
Yes, in 1996, the Senate was 2020, and it had just gone 2020. The Democrats had controlled it previously. And the lieutenant governor at the time was Lieutenant Governor Don Beyer, a Democrat. And he and the Democrats who had been in power worked out an agreement for power sharing with the Republicans who had just gained their 20th vote, so that there were co-chairmen of committees. But basically, this was something that had been insisted upon by a state senator on the Democratic side, Virgil Goode, who later became a congressman, first as a Democrat, then as an independent, then as a Republican, a conservative Democrat, insisted that he was going to vote with the Republicans, as Bob has mentioned, might be possible, unless there was power sharing. So we don't see anyone on the Republican side willing to hold their feet to the fire the way Virgil Goode did, right, to insist on power sharing.
That's right.
I think what's really important here is that there is no legal precedent. This has never gone to court.
Correct.
And that's the problem here, is that no one really knows because it hasn't gone to court.
But well, Anita Kumar from the Washington Post, I understand that you have been talking to some Democratic senators who look like they're about to lose their power in the Senate. I want to ask you some specifics about what you've been hearing, but we're already getting some calls here at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. For anybody who just tuned in, you're welcome to call in and join the conversation. Tom in Stanton, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Bob Roberts, Bob Gibson, and or Anita Kumar, please.
Yeah, great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A number of Republican-controlled governments around the country have been recently enacting a number of laws that are restricting voter registration and requiring restrictions on showing up at the polls and whether you have to have photo ID or things like that. What are the chances that kind of legislation will be enacted in Virginia now?
I haven't heard any, but it wouldn't surprise me. Virginia has an identification requirement, but it's pretty broad. And Virginia law also says if you don't have identification, you can vote a provisional ballot. So that has never been a difficult issue in Virginia. Whether there'll be an attempt to narrow that law in terms of what will satisfy identification is possible. I strongly doubt the governor would want that to happen. And the dilemma with the Republicans pushing any radical agenda is that will simply activate the Democratic base in the state, and you don't want to do that in the 2012 presidential and senatorial race. So I think the governor can be very cautious in terms of how far he will let the legislature go.
Anita Kumar, at the state capitol in Richmond, in your talks with legislators, have you heard anything about pushing for increased voter ID requirements?
Unfortunately, I couldn't hear him, so I didn't quite hear that question. But
the caller was talking about was whether, like Republican majorities in legislatures and other places in the country, have been pushing for increased voter ID requirements.
Right, and they have been pushing in other states, and it actually has come up in Virginia, but it never, again, like many other things, it hasn't gone anywhere. And I do know that several groups, including like the League of Women Voters, they assume now that this is going to be on the list of one of the bills that could pass because both chambers are Republican.
Tom, it's a great question. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Bob Gibson, the usual reading on this is that increased restrictions or making it a little tougher for people to vote favors Republicans.
I think there's some empirical evidence to show that early voting and increased voting brings out perhaps a little bit of a more and more poor element in the population that might be leaning to the Democrats in some elections. So there is a push among Republicans to sort of limit early voting and to require more identification at the polls. Not every voter has a photo ID, and as Bob pointed out, Virginia's law is fairly relaxed on that. You can vote a provisional ballot if you don't have your photo ID with you at the polls.
But Bob Gibson, as the other Bob was analyzing, his reading is that Republicans want to be careful about that kind of push in Virginia because they don't want to so energize the Democratic base that they'll come out and vote for Obama in bigger numbers in the presidential election next year. Isn't the view on the part of some Republicans, in your experience, that this might be a good thing for a presidential election because it will make it more difficult for more Democrats to vote?
There is a tension going into this session between members of the Republican base who are conservative, who want to press for issues that have been traditionally blocked in the Senate and now might not be blocked in the Senate, and Republicans such as Bill Bowling and Governor McDonnell, who may want to temper somewhat the ability of the base to prevail on many of these issues, including restricting voting.
Anita, we're going to hit the break soon, but I want to go back to where we were talking a few minutes ago about some of the legislation that passed through the Republican House in previous sessions, died in what was then a democratically controlled Senate. Any big measures strike you as things that are sure to pass the House again and now would stand a much better chance of making it through the Senate and into law?
Sure. I mean, I think you hit on some of the big overall topics: abortion, immigration, the expanding the death penalty, and gun rights. I think all of those things are going to come back, and I guess it depends on individual bills. So I could mention a couple in Virginia.
Tell us a little bit about the gun rights bills.
Right. In Virginia, for years now, they've been talking about repealing Virginia's law on purchasing one handgun a month. Comes up every year. Every year it dies.
But it has passed the House many times, including the most recent session.
Yeah, that's correct. I think people think that will definitely come back. There's also bills that would allow...
Just to make sure I understand, this would allow people in Virginia to no longer be restricted to how many guns they could buy, no more than 12 a year, one per month. They could buy as many as they wanted when they wanted.
Right.
And it looks like that might stand a better chance in the Senate.
Right. And it's a very contentious issue. Every year it comes back. It's been on the books. It's been a law for about 20 years now.
Wasn't there also a measure that passed the House in this last session, died in the Senate, that would have allowed people to carry guns onto any government property, including college campuses?
Right. Libraries, emergency shelters, parks, and as you said, college campuses. And so that would definitely return.
Any chance you think, Bob Roberts, that the governor, who is also a Republican, would sign that into law?
I think he would have to sign the gun bills into law. Because that's part of his base, and gun rights is essential, and therefore I don't think he would stop those.
Anita Kumar, Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts are with us. When we get back from the break, we expect to be talking with a longtime Democratic member of the state Senate who looks like he's about to join the minority in his chamber. We'll get his view and then some other state lawmakers as well when we continue here on Virginia Insight. Our analysis panel today on Virginia Insight includes Richmond-based political reporter Anita Kumar of The Washington Post, former newspaper reporter and now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Policy Departments, Bob Roberts. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and joining us now by phone, Democratic State Senator from the 25th District, stretching from Bath County in the west all the way east to Charlottesville, Cree Deeds. Good to be talking with you again, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
Is there any doubt in your mind that come January and the new session of the General Assembly, Republicans will be in control of the state Senate?
Well, the whole notion that there's a majority is a fiction. It's not supported by the Constitution of Virginia. It takes 21 members of the Senate to organize the Senate. It takes 21 members of the Senate to pass the budget. It takes 21 members of the Senate to elect judges. You know, there's not a fiction. Now, do they have the ability to break tie votes? They do with the lieutenant governor, and that gives them a leg up, but there's not a majority party.
Does it make it more likely that Republican-backed legislation that's come out of the House in the past to be killed by Democrats in the Senate is now going to get through the Senate?
Well, they've got two more votes, so I guess it makes it more likely. They have two more votes, and that's we'll just have to wait and see how the particular pieces of legislation play out.
Bob Roberts, you were saying that you think there are some constitutional issues here, but that you'd have to force it to court and the Democrats would have to walk out of the Senate. Cree wasn't listening then. No, he's in Fairfax right now.
In a sense, they would effectively have to try to delay the session until they would get a court ruling.
As I see it, you know, in 1996, I was in the House of Delegates at that time, part of what happened is that the two sides, neither one would take the Senate floor.
Right.
And so they denied either side a quorum. It takes 21 senators to create a quorum and to allow the Senate to come to order, and you can't organize the Senate until you begin to organize, until you get 21 people there. So, and that 21 people doesn't include the lieutenant governor.
The Republican view, it does. It includes,
You're both lawyers, by the way.
The Republican,
in 1996, in 1996, the Democrats got an opinion from A.E. Dick Howard, who was involved in drafting the Constitution back in 71.
Right.
And that says his opinion was that the lieutenant governor could be involved. But the Republicans got an opinion from Jim Gilmore, who was the attorney general at the time, and that opinion said it could.
Correct.
So I happen to agree with the attorney general's opinion in this instance.
And I don't think you'd get the same opinion from this attorney general.
So 15 years ago, things were flipped when the Republicans were facing a Democratic lieutenant governor. They felt that lieutenant governor should not hold sway. We only have Senator Deeds for a few moments more. And I think, Bob Gibson, you had a question you wanted to ask Cree.
Sure. Senator Deeds, what is it clear the lieutenant governor can cast a vote on? What is it clear the lieutenant governor cannot cast a vote on? And what is unclear about whether the lieutenant governor can cast a vote on something?
Well, you know, our bedrock document is the Constitution of Virginia. The Constitution of Virginia says the lieutenant governor can break ties when there's an equal division. He can't, I don't think, under the Constitution, he can vote on budget issues. I don't think he can vote to elect judges. And I don't think he can vote to organize the Senate. I don't think he can constitute a member of a quorum. He can break ties on just about everything else. It's the way I look at the Constitution. Now, there are going to be people with different agreements or different understandings, but that's my understanding of the law.
Senator Deeds, I think bottom line what we're hearing from you is we have to stay tuned to see how this is going to work out. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of that Senate Finance Committee retreat that you are at in Fairfax, Virginia today. By the way, since you're at that Finance Committee hearing, have you heard anything about what size shortfall the state is looking at in budget?
To a large extent, we're all waiting for what happens with the deficit committee in D.C. You know, in Virginia, we receive more military, more federal spending on a per capita basis than any other state in the union, except Alaska. So, you know, what happens to Virginia's budget picture will relate very directly what to whatever agreement they reach in Washington, if they reach an agreement at all. What we're looking at total, you know, is probably a shortfall between expected revenues and expected expenditures, somewhere between $600 million and $1 billion. That's what we're looking at, unless we get a more drastic reduction in funding from the federal government.
Senator Cree Deeds from Bath County, thank you so much for making time for us, sir, on Virginia Insight. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you, sir. See you.
Now on the phone line with us, Republican state senator from the 27th District, one of the areas in that district that's also included in the WMRA listening region. That would include the city of Winchester, plus Frederick and Clark counties. Senator Jill Vogo, good to be speaking with you again.
It's great to be with you. It's so funny because I'm here at the Finance Committee briefing, and I'm looking across the room at Cree Deeds, and I'm glad that
he was on his cell on one side of the room, and you're on your cell on the other.
I know. That's hilarious that we can actually now speak on the phone on the radio when we're, you know,
And my guess,
15 feet from each other, yeah.
My guess, Senator, is that you might have a slightly different view than Senator Deeds in terms of whether or not Republicans now have control of the state Senate, or will as of January.
Well, I will tell you, because I was in there listening to a riveting budget explanation, I didn't get to hear, I didn't have the benefit of hearing what Cree's explanation was. But
well, Cree's view is what you would expect most Democrats to have, that the lieutenant governor can only vote on limited number of things, not organizing the Senate.
I get it. I understand that completely, and I understand that most people's impression is that we have a Senate divided equally right now, 2020. But the relevant factor is that while lots of votes are not a straight party line vote, lots of votes are based on region, lots of votes are based on lots of other issues. But when it comes to the very, very big ones, the ones that are more partisan, you will see that this is very likely going to be a 20-20 split. And what gives you the majority is that you've got the 21st vote. So you can, you know, cut and slice it and message it any way you want to. But the truth is what the truth is. It's 2020, so it's evenly divided. But when it comes to those critical, more likely politically charged issues, we're going to win because we have a lieutenant governor to cast a vote. I believe, in agreement with where his party will be. And for sure, that has an enormous impact. And that has led to, you know, Senator Tommy Norman yesterday elected the majority leader of the Senate by our caucus. He is the majority leader. So I don't think there's any ambiguity about that, because whoever gets to 21 is the majority.
Well, Jill, by the way, I just want to warn Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, because I've pulled this on her before as a surprise, and so I don't want to surprise her this time. Since I gave the two Bobs on our panel a chance to ask questions of the previous senator, I was going to ask Anita if she had a question for you after I ask this question of you, Jill, if I could.
Okay,
so I've confused everybody listening right now. But Jill,
yes, I'm totally
first of all,
confused about who's on, but I'm happy to take questions from everybody. So
we have Bob Roberts from James Madison University, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Anita Kumar from the Washington Post. And thank you for asking, because there are other people who tuned in who just recently didn't know either. But two things, Jill, I understand that you have actually you've just been promoted. You're now one of the caucus whips
for the
Republicans. Congratulations on that. But from that position, what I'm curious about, Senator, is what legislation would you say Republicans have pushed for, especially legislation that's gotten past the House, previously died in the Democratic-controlled Senate, that now is going to make it through both houses into law?
Oh, I think there are a litany of issues and lots of pieces of legislation. I think you often find that the budget is obviously the locus of lots of that discussion, lots of that fight. So lots of budget issues that, you know, were very relevant sometimes hit that brick wall, because obviously the governor and the House being the same party had a more similar view. So there's some of those issues, but really at the macro level, when you're thinking about what are the biggies, well, they're obvious ones. There's some energy issues. I think legislation that in the past didn't either died or succeeded because of the difference in the majorities. I think you'll see social issues. Obviously, that's going to be relevant. I think there'll be more tax legislation.
Social issues?
Does that
include
legislation?
Joe, when you say socialist Jews, does that include some of those further restrictions on abortion that made it through the House, you think are now more likely to make it through the Senate?
I think some of the restrictions you will see will come out of committee and will be voted on by the Senate. I think that, you know, so there are lots and lots of issues that
You've been in an area that's got to be important to our listeners. You've been one of the Republican stopgaps in the past. Last year, when the House wanted to eliminate all funding for the arts and all funding for public broadcasting, you were among the majority who said no.
That's true. And I will tell you that that's why it's hard to say that they're hard and fast rules. I peel off from my caucus on lots of issues where I personally feel very strongly that was one of them. Lots of issues related to the environment, energy, and the like. I am not always in lockstep with my caucus. And so, you know, while there are no guarantees about how legislation will come out, we have some independent-minded people.
Anita Kumar, you have one question for Senator Vogel?
Sure, I'll just take you, Senator Vogel, I'll take you back to the 2020 split. You know, as you know, in the 90s, there were two opinions on this. One went one way, one went the other. Why are the Republicans so sure that, you know, it was actually A. Dick Howard from the University of Virginia? Why are you all so sure that that's the one here that should matter, meaning Lieutenant Governor can vote on a variety of things, organizational, budget, tax bills, all the things that the Democrats are now saying he cannot?
Well, I missed that earlier discussion when Cree was outlining that, and I'm familiar with some of that history, but you know, I'm not here to say that I believe that the lieutenant can that the lieutenant governor can vote on all of those things. I think he can break the critical ties, and you know, but I'm not certain that he can vote on everything.
But there's no question in your mind that you are now in the majority.
My sense is, having talked to the leadership on both sides, and, you know, with the appreciation that the floor leader, and certainly the floor leader, has enormous impact. And Senator Tommy Norman, who is the leader of the Republican caucus, will be the floor leader. And so some of the decisions that he gets to make about, you know, how legislation moves and what happens on the floor is very relevant. So, you know, from the basis of pure optics and having the person who can cast a tie-breaking vote, my sense is that, you know, that equals a majority on most of the issues where it's going to be a straight party line vote.
State Senator Jill Vogel from the 27th District, which in our listening area includes Frederick and Clark counties in the city of Winchester, Republican. Senator, thank you so much for stepping out of that riveting budget discussion in order to share a few minutes with us.
Yes, Cree and I are going to go back to work and get back in there and get ready to hear what's really happening in Virginia. What was really fascinating was how much of this initial discussion all hinges on what happens in Congress.
Cree did mention that if there is a significant cut in the federal budget, that means lots of federal workers, including military, get I guess they lose their jobs, lose their paychecks. Yeah. That means a lot less money spent in Virginia and a lot less tax revenue for the state.
Well, and because of Virginia's proximity, we are so uniquely tied to the federal government, and our economy and our jobs have, you know, are so connected. So absolutely, it matters to us perhaps more than any other state in the union.
Jill, thanks so much for your time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care. It was good to be with all of you guys.
Thank you.
Joining us now by phone, the outgoing state senator from the 17th district, Democrat from the Fredericksburg area, Ed Hauk. Senator Hauk, thank you for making time for us.
Sure, it's nice to be on, and hello to everybody.
Hello.
So you've got Anita Kumar from the Washington Post, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Bob Roberts from James Madison University, waiting with bated breath, I'm sure, for the answer to this first question. It was 1 week ago today, with the unofficial tally in your race against Republican challenger Bryce Reeves showing you behind by just 222 votes, something less than 0.5%, you conceded that election to your opponent. How come?
Well, prior to Election Day, we had indications that the race was going to be close. We had assembled a legal team, top-notch election legal team, to be prepared in case it came as close as it ended up being. So the day after election, when the canvassing occurred in each of the localities, we had a legal person, an experienced election legal attorney, and some local Ed Hauk supporters watching the local canvassing through Wednesday. Unfortunately, it was not completed on Wednesday due to what was reported to me, an illness with the registrar in Louisa County. So the official canvass did not officially get completed until Thursday morning. Thursday afternoon at 2:30 following Election Day, we had a conference call with all of the attorneys, my campaign manager and myself, Steve Palazzino from the Senate Democratic Caucus. And we went through, or listened to, the attorneys went through the analysis of what they had found. And based upon the legal advice and the political advice that I received on that conference call, there was, quote, a very, very remote chance that a recount would overcome the 222, which I think now is actually 224, if I'm correct. But in any event, there was a very, very remote chance that a recount would overturn that. I felt it was incumbent upon me, because we had so many supporters that were just hanging on with bated breath that somehow a miracle was going to occur with a recount, that I would end up prevailing. But once I knew from the legal experts and political experts that that was not a possibility, I felt that it was better to just concede and not linger until the first part of December and perpetuate some false hope among the supporters, myself, my wife, all of us. It just seemed it was not appropriate to know there was little, if any, chance that there would be a difference and prolong this thing for another month. So
Bob
I
Roberts,
made the
excuse me, Senator. Bob Roberts had a question for you.
Question, why are Democrats having so difficult a time in rural areas? And just not this election. Election after election, Democrats do well in suburban areas, this time urban areas. But when they're having just a very, very difficult time in rural areas. What's going on?
Well, to be very candid about it, I think the president's approval ratings, which are somewhat low in many areas of the state, certainly in my district, they were immensely low. The Republicans used a full-blown attack on me of tying me directly to the president in TV ads, radio ads, numerous mailings of the Halk Obama team. I think outside of those urban pockets where the president still has very decent approval ratings, I think in the rural areas you just can't find that. And I'm not saying that that was the sole determiner, but in looking at it, it was clearly the strategy that they used.
Senator, we have you on the air here for just a few more moments before we hit the break. You in the past have fought against the efforts to completely eliminate funding for the arts from state government and completely eliminate funding for public broadcasting that the governor has asked for and that the House Republicans have pushed for. The fact that Democrats are no longer in control and you're no longer going to be there, does that mean that those eliminations in funding are coming?
I would predict they're gone. The only reason they were there is because, as one of the budget conferees, along with my Senate colleagues...
Senator, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Can you stay with us? Okay, we'll be right back. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Here with me in the Insight studio from James Madison University's Politics Department, Bob Roberts. Joining us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the guy who heads up the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. And with us by phone from the Washington Post, Virginia political reporter Anita Kumar. Also with us on the phone line for just a few minutes more is the outgoing Democratic State Senator from the 17th District, Fredericksburg area, Democrat Ed Hauk. And Senator, you were just telling us about what you think the future is of state funding for public broadcasting and for the arts.
Well, I think it's twofold, the answer. Number one, I think it's gone, primarily because that was not the governor or the House's intent. I don't see the Republican Senate acquiescing to that. And then just the overall revenue outlook is looking very, very serious for the upcoming session and perhaps into the second year of the biennium. So I think both of those coming together, this will not be a priority for the governor, and I don't think it'll be a priority for the Republicans.
Anita Kumar.
Yes, Senator, I think we spoke, or I spoke to your campaign manager about how this year you have always had a tough re-election every year, and I believe this is your first election that you've lost. You were really targeted by some outside groups this time, a couple PACs. I know that you had mentioned this whole thing about how the Republicans were trying to make it sound like you were, you know, hand in hand with Barack Obama. I know that was a statewide thing that went on in districts all over the place, but you were really targeted on abortion by two political action committees. I wondered if you thought that made a difference.
Well, it's really hard to determine that, Anita. It was definitely a very negative, hard-hitting, over-the-top attack, trying to create a political wedge, particularly with black ministers on gay rights and abortion. They really went way, way overbound, tying me to the Ku Klux Klan and to, you know, the genocide of black babies and et cetera. So they put a lot of focus into it. I have not had enough analysis yet to really see whether that had a significant impact or not. It's not on the surface obvious from the predominantly black precincts and Fredericksburg and elsewhere in the district, so I really can't say, but they definitely put a lot of stock and money in the Speaker of the House, Bill Howe, helped fund the whole effort. So it was
this
the first time,
like,
I think I was the only one in the state that really got this much intensity on that.
This was probably the most negative race you've had, I would guess, right?
Oh, absolutely, by far.
And this was your eighth run. You'd been elected seven times before for four-year terms.
That's correct.
Bob Gibson, you had a final question for Senator Houck.
Yes, Senator Houck, the last time the Senate was split 2020 in 1996, the precedent was established to share power between the parties. This was successfully done with an amicable relationship and a Democratic lieutenant governor at the time, Don Beyer. It doesn't appear that this is happening this time, but what chance is there that some sort of power sharing or less than power sharing but a power-sharing light agreement might be reached before this General Assembly convenes on January the 11th?
Well, Bob, just, you know, I haven't really had discussions with anyone, just reading the news clips and et cetera. It seems the Republicans are hell-bent to have complete domination. So I'm going to predict, just based on what I've read, that power-sharing is not going to occur as it has previously. I don't think the moderate to conservative Republicans in the Senate, which are now definitely minority among their group, I don't think they can withstand the Tea Party pressure, the pressure from the ultra-conservatives, both in the Senate and from the House, and I think even from the governor's office. So I don't believe there will be power sharing, certainly not as we had it before.
Democrat from the Fredericksburg area after 28 years in the Virginia Senate, now outgoing State Senator Ed Houck, thank you so much for making time for us, sir.
Glad to do it, and enjoyed having the chance to chat with you guys.
Hope we can do it again soon, sir.
Thank you.
888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. If you listening have any thoughts to share about the future of Virginia politics, now that it looks fairly certain that Republicans are in control of both the House, where they have a huge majority, historic majority now, never been this big before. And I'm looking at you, Bob, but you're looking away, so you can comment on that later. Also, it looks like with the tie-breaking vote of the Republican lieutenant governor, will control the state Senate. We have a couple of comments that have come in on Facebook. This is from Robert, who says, with control of the legislature comes responsibility. That majority will have responsibility for their actions or lack of action. Does that spark any thoughts on your part, Bob Gibson?
Yes, I think there's going to be an attempt by the governor and the lieutenant governor, Bob McDonnell and Bill Bowling, to sort of curb the total package that could come forward from the House of Delegates, which is so heavily Republican at 66 members of the House, the 100-member House.
And doesn't have very many what might be called moderate Republicans in it. They're all quite conservative.
They tend to be, and the majority, as Ed Hauck pointed out, the majority of the Senate Republican caucus tends to be conservative now, quite conservative. So there will be an attempt by the leadership to perhaps send some things forward and perhaps hold others the other things back so that the party doesn't do what sometimes parties do when they freshly attain power, which is to try to overreach a little bit.
But Bob Roberts, with our Facebooker here, Robert, talking about being held responsible for lack of action, might that not imply that some of the Republican base are going to be really dissatisfied if their party's leaders don't take the bull by the horns?
That's why I don't think McDonald can hold very much up. I think the only way this can be done without irritating the base of the Republican Party and get retaliation is for a very sophisticated form of manipulation by Republicans within the Senate. In other words, things don't get out of the conference committee. Things don't get out of committees that the governor doesn't want out of committees. With the governor behind the scenes saying, I can't have these coming to the floor. I don't think the governor can do this through vetoes or stopping votes on the floor.
I think Ron here on Facebook has a completely opposite view of the Republican base we were talking about, because he says here, there is one problem with who actually controls the Senate. With an even split, the parties used to agree on sharing the control. Now the GOP has become a bully with authoritarian aspirations. I would say bring it on, and we will see how much stomach the general public, most of whom did not bother to vote, has to tolerate the toxic brew the GOP has in store. I would say that was definitely not a Republican who wrote that.
That's right.
But Anita Kumar, does this bring to mind a sense of there are things that might well happen in Richmond in the next few months that could mean better news for energizing Democrats come the presidential election of next November?
Yeah, I think Bob mentioned that earlier, and I would definitely agree. I mean, if some of these things that we talked about earlier pass, some of the social issues that Senator Vogel mentioned, I think that Democrats...
Let me ask you about the specific of that, since Senator Vogel did say that she sees further abortion restrictions now being likely to pass both chambers. One of the ones, do I recall correctly, had something to do with requiring women to watch a sonogram of their fetus if they wanted to get an abortion?
Right. That one has passed before in the House and has died. There's also, I can't remember if we mentioned these before, but making it a crime for a woman to cause her own miscarriage. I think that some people on the opposite side of that bill were sort of appalled that basically you're investigating a pregnancy. You know, police would be involved in that. I think that actually came up in one of the Northern Virginia races.
There also something about someone being criminally liable if they persuaded a woman to have an abortion?
Right, coerced someone to have an abortion.
Okay, it depends on how you define coerce, I guess.
Right. I mean, it's correct. I mean, we'd have to look at the exact language, and of course the language is always parsed.
And there's almost certainly to be an expansion of the death penalty?
Right. They've been trying to get in something for quite some time that would basically expand it to, I guess, the accomplices, people that are involved but maybe that don't pull the trigger.
The so-called trigger man rule.
Correct.
If I order Bob Roberts to go and kill somebody and he takes my order and takes pay for it, under current law, if he's convicted, he would be liable for the death penalty, but I wouldn't.
That's
Republicans
right.
have said that's just not fair.
Right.
So in order to get me to the gas chamber or death penalty chamber, they needed the Senate to agree with them, and now it looks like they might.
Right, they will.
Yeah, they might. And that, I think we were talking earlier, I don't think the governor would have a problem with some of these gun rights issues. Obviously, he used to be the attorney general. He's a very much a law and order guy who's tried to put some, you know, into the police and sheriffs. He's tried to restore some cuts and things like that. I don't think he'd have a problem with some of those. He might have a problem with some of the other issues that we're talking about. He calls himself a social and fiscal conservative, and he is, but he has not stressed some of those things his first 2 years in
office. Can you think of one that you think he might have a problem with?
Well, I just don't think he thinks that, you know, that the General Assembly should be dealing with. You know, he thinks the number one issue, or his number one issue, is jobs. You ask him his other issues, he might say transportation and education. I just don't know that he wants to be dealing with, you know, a ton of abortion and immigration and other other issues. I mean,
Chad in Charlottesville has taken the time to join us. Chad, we've been keeping you on hold for a moment, so I'm going to be rude to Anita and cut her off so I can stop being rude to you and put you on the air. Chad, thanks so much.
All right, great. Good afternoon. On the website, it indicated there was going to be some talk about taking money out of education and health care in order to fund transportation, so I'd really like to hear you discuss that. Certainly in light of the past couple of years, there's been no agreement in Richmond during the legislative session about how to fund transportation. We just heard Senator Deeds talk about a $600 million to a billion hole in the budget.
Right.
And I'm here in Charlottesville, and we have there's a big road project that a lot of us are unhappy about, the Western Bypass, that is going to cost between $250 and $400 million. Where is that money going to come from?
Chad, I'm not sure we can answer all of your questions, especially since we're running short on time, but I think Anita can answer the general one about what happened in the past session
right. When
the governor proposed taking money out of the general fund.
Well, he wouldn't exactly call it the way you did. But basically, the governor has proposed and still believes, because I talked to him about this not too long ago, and will propose again to divert money from the general fund. And Democrats like to say, and it's true, that the general fund is used for everything, and it's used for so many things, including
education. But by far the two biggest
education. Mm-hmm.
Two biggest items in the general fund are money for education and money for health care.
Correct.
So if you take money out of the general fund, you have to be taking it away from education and health care.
And I would agree.
And Republicans in the House last year, in the House, where the Republicans had the majority, had a little bit of trouble with the governor's proposal.
That's right. And he says he will come back. I mean, the governor says transportation is one of his top priorities for this coming session. He has managed to get through them, the General Assembly last time, basically bonding $4 billion. So basically, you know, it's debt. But he says, you know, we need to do something else. He will be proposing again using tax, so existing general fund money, for transportation.
And Bob Gibson, with your many years before you went to the Sorenson Institute of covering politics in Richmond, I want to direct this next question to you. In the last session, when it came to budget cutting, the House cut considerably more from education funding than the Senate did. Some people think that sometimes the House does that kind of thing because they know that it's going to die in the Senate, or that it's going to be ameliorated in the Senate, which is exactly what happened. There was a compromise last year, and much of the money the House would have cut out was reduced. They still cut some, but not as much as the House wanted. Now that Republicans are in control of both the Senate and the House, when it comes to choosing where the budget has to cut, is it likely education's going to get a further hit?
Well, that remains to be seen. It is possible, and it is true that the House used to vote for things knowing that the Senate would not go along, and vice versa, the Senate would vote for things knowing the House would not go along. Now they have to be a little bit more in concert on their money committees if they're going to effectively figure out the state's priorities and have their own policy as opposed to the governor's policy. I think there will be modification to the governor's budget. I think the more popular items to be cut will be cut, and the more popular items to be spared cuts will be spared, as many cuts as they can spare them. But where education falls is crucial and to be determined.
So, Chad, thank you so much for your call. Since we are just about out of time, we've only touched a little bit on presidential politics, but we haven't heard Gibson's take on this yet. How do you think all this is going to wash out as far as how it affects presidential election time, Bob Gibson?
Well, I think our governor, Bob McDonnell, as one of the most popular governors in the union right now, given approval ratings around the various states, is very much looking at who is going to be a possible running mate. And if it's Mitt Romney, if Mitt Romney holds up and maintains his slight lead, which keeps evaporating at times, but his polling numbers hold relatively steady, and becomes the nominee, then a Southern running mate, such as a governor, such as Bob McDonnell, becomes pretty high on the short list. And the other name, of course, is Mark Rubio, the the senator and Hispanic descendant of Cuban family in Florida, who is also being looked at very, very seriously on a very short list. I think presidential politics will have a great deal to do with what happens next year.
We can't really ask Anita for her opinion because she's supposed to be an unbiased reporter. So we're going to ask for you to finish with the 20 seconds we've got left.
I think the governor faces a very difficult task. He's got to satisfy his base, who controls. And at the same time, he can't be too radical or he's going to really help Obama's chances and Tim Kaine's chances in Virginia and possibly eliminate him as a vice presidential candidate. So it's a very, very difficult task he has to follow.
So to track, we'll have to ask you guys back soon. Our guests have been Director of the University of Virginia's Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson, Professor of Politics and Public Policy from James Madison University, Bob Roberts. Earlier in the program, Virginia State Senators Cree Deeds, Jill Vogel, and Ed Hauck. By the way, the gentleman, Bryce Reeves, who won what had been the Hauck seat, was invited to join us in this program, and his staff said that he had a scheduling conflict. And by the way, still on the phone line with us, Washington Post political reporter and Charlottesville native Anita Kumar. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.